Okay, here we go. Didactic Mind, Episode 18, The Greatest Lies. Very warm welcome to everybody listening in, all of my loyal readers from the blog, all of my SoundCloud subscribers. It's good to see you back. And this is the 18th episode so far of my podcast series. If you're not already subscribed, then please hit the subscribe button. Make sure that you never ever miss a new upload. And stop by the blog as well, and enjoy my work in a different form, because I personally think I write better than I speak. Some of you may disagree with that, but that's just my personal take on things. I'm better in the written word than in the spoken, in my opinion. The blog is full of good stuff from ranging from politics to philosophy to just ridiculous random YouTube videos to, of course, heavy metal and film. So, plenty of interesting material to explore there. Today, I want to talk to you about basically the subject of lies. Now, I've addressed this a couple of times before in two other podcasts, Lies, Damned Lies and Truths, and another one more recently. But This one is inspired by a couple of comments that I saw running around in various forums. I think one of them may have been on our friend the Gentleman Adventurer's blog not too long ago, where one of the commenters talked about the second greatest lie ever told, or maybe it was John C. Wright, I can't remember. But essentially, the topic was on the great lies that we are told as human beings. And the two greatest lies that we've ever been told are, number one, and ye shall be as gods. And number two, whatever you're going through, you're going to go through it alone. These are terrible lies, and they have been used by our enemy, by the great deceiver, to isolate us, to separate us from the will and the power of the Lord. And this has been nothing short of a disaster for all of us. All of us have been afflicted and affected by these lies. And while we're on the subject of lies which afflict and affect us, let me take a moment to address the ongoing spread of Corona-chan. Corona-chan, for those of you who aren't familiar with meme culture, is, of course, the avatar of the coronavirus, which has done a magnificent job of spreading all over the world thus far. I think we're up to, what is it? Well, according to the Daily Mail, as of right now, I think we're up to 85,000 odd cases and 2,922 deaths worldwide. Now, the media and many aspects of the government, the financial industry, and various others would have you believe that this is unprecedented, that this is a plague which is going to kill millions. Well, no, not really. Let's be clear about a few things. If you're not of East Asian ethnic origin, if you're not over the age of 50, or, yeah, pretty much over the age of 50, and if you have a healthy immune system, and if you take good care of yourself, drink lots of fluids, wash your hands, wash your body, and generally avoid contact with people from East Asia, let's be blunt about it, I'm not saying that's a good thing, I'm just saying that's what you have to do, then you're probably going to be okay. 85,000 infections, to put this into perspective, is roughly in the ballpark of how many people get infected with the flu, just the flu, or not infected, I believe it's actually die from the flu, in the United States alone every year. Mostly among the elderly and the weak, okay? Let's go look it up. I've got my recording this on a computer, so Annual flu infections. Annual flu deaths. Facts and statistics about the flu. This is from Healthline. And what are we looking at? Yeah. It's really not a big deal. Flu, for instance, 5 to 20% of the U.S. population gets flu every year. Again, that's the U.S. population. We're not talking about 1.4 billion people. We're talking about one quarter of that number, about 330-odd million people. So if 5% of that population gets the flu every year, that's about 18 million people. Okay. Between 5 and 20%, we're talking about between 18 and, 65 million people every year get the flu. 65 million people, right? Now, from that set, there are some, 60 plus thousand deaths that occur every year. During the severe, in a really severe flu season, one of the longest in recent years, this is from Healthline, during the very severe 2017 to 18 flu season, one of the longest in recent years, estimates indicate that more than 900,000 people were hospitalized and more than 80,000 died from the flu. Okay, to my American friends, that's what you're facing in perspective, okay? The flu in your country infects 10 times the number of people that have, every year, that have been infected globally so far with the coronavirus. The flu kills all of the, pretty much the number of people who have just been infected globally every year. So what we're facing is not a world-killing disease. The mortality rate of this COVID-19 SARS derivative virus is only about 1 to 2.5%, depending. Now, what we know about this virus tells us that if you get infected the first time, it's not so bad. It's just really mild to severe cold symptoms. It's miserable, but you'll get through it. What's dangerous is getting infected the second time, because apparently the antibody chains, or the antibodies which are created from the first infection, don't last very long. So it has a very short memory inside of your body. Your body's ability to fight it is not going to be that great when you get infected the second time, because after a few weeks, your body will have forgotten how to fight it. And if you get infected a second time, then you're in trouble. But that being said, don't panic too much about it, because there's really no reason to panic. This is not a particularly dangerous virus. It's an unpleasant virus when you get it, but its mortality rate is vastly lower than the SARS outbreak of 2003. It's vastly lower than the SARS outbreak of 2012. In fact, hell, I was there in Singapore in 2003 when SARS broke out. Okay, I remember what a disaster it was for the country. I don't remember anything about SARS breaking out in 2012. I have no memory of that, but apparently there was an outbreak. By comparison, this virus, although it is vastly more infectious and has spread much more widely, because in the 20-odd years since SARS happened, global transport networks have become much more congested, integrated, and so on and so forth. There's nothing to indicate so far that we're dealing with anything particularly horrifying. I mean, we're not dealing with something on the order of the Spanish flu. We're not dealing with something like the Black Death. We're not bubonic plague, essentially. We're not dealing even with an outbreak of H5N1. If H5N1 jumps the species barrier and becomes transmissible between humans, oh boy, we're screwed. The whole planet is doomed at that point. But that's not what's happening. That's not the case right now, okay? So, don't allow yourself to fall for the media hype. Don't allow yourself to fall for the lies. By all means, stock up on a few supplies. Go out there, stock up on some bottled water, get yourself some canned food, get yourself enough supplies to last for about 2 to 3 weeks, just in case you need it, okay? Just in case you have to be self-isolated, self-contained for some amount of time. Don't go full prepper because there's no need for it. China has about one third of its population apparently on full lockdown. I mean, 500 million odd Chinese just not doing anything right now. And that's, the Chinese know perfectly well that that's going to tank their economy, dump it straight in the shitter. And they've accepted that outcome because they're already facing pressures on multiple fronts. I mean, his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of Mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, has already hurt the Chinese economy very badly with the imposition of quite potent sanctions on Chinese manufacturing. And that's a good thing. It's long overdue that he did that. But the Chinese themselves are discovering very quickly that their economy is not as robust as they thought it was. They are very much an economy built on lies. And again, this comes back to the theme that I wanted to talk about. The problem with building anything on lies is that eventually it always collapses. And the Chinese are no exception. The Chinese have built their entire way of life around a series of lies. And I'm not talking about their culture. I actually quite like ancient Chinese culture. I'm talking about their current way of life, wherein they have based their entire situation on the belief that their way of doing things is vastly superior to everybody else's. It's not. Their culture, such as it was irreparably damaged by the Cultural Revolution and by the Great Leap Forward and by communism in general. Now that's not to say that they won't survive. It is to say, however, that their trust in God kings and emperors has proven to be profoundly misplaced. The Chinese culture right now is very much of a low trust society. Their entire society is built around the idea that you can't really trust anyone other than your own family and your elders. That's it. You can't trust the government, you can't trust the state, but paradoxically, the Chinese put enormous kind of burden on the government to get things done. They don't really have that same level of independent initiative that a lot of Western Europeans do, especially Americans, especially Brits and Scots, you know, people of British, Scottish, and Dutch descent. And there are a lot of reasons for that, cultural and historical. But the reason why they're struggling right now is because the Chinese experiment was built on a major lie, which is that you can simply export your way out of trouble at all times, and that the government can simply be authoritarian enough and commanding enough to force the people to do whatever to do whatever it wants them to do. That is being put very much to the test. The Chinese government is, like most authoritarian regimes, is terrified of the truth. And that is precisely what got them into so much trouble with this coronavirus outbreak. I mean, they basically locked down cities of tens of millions of people. You're not allowed to go out. You're not allowed to leave the house easily. You're under curfew at all times. Relatives who do leave the house can only leave once every 3 days to pick up supplies. And only one member of the house can go at a time. It's a pretty miserable existence. And when the outbreak started to ease a little bit, or seemed to, the Chinese basically ordered millions of workers back to work, only to find that they didn't necessarily want to go, because their trust had been damaged so badly in the system. Rightly so, as it happens. The problem is, of course, that the Chinese succumbed to one of the two great lies, the greatest of the lies, and ye shall be as gods. Now, this lie is the foundation of all other lies. The reason why it is so powerful, the reason why it still has such grave effect, even today, is because the Lord of Lies uttered this in the Garden of Eden to Eve and to Adam, and that is why we today have to deal with the legacy of sin and corruption that has come from it, from that one lie. This was a colossal lie, and we should, our forebears in the garden should never ever have listened to it. But they did, and here we are. Now, I've heard arguments made, I think somewhat superficially persuasive ones at least, that God created mankind to be almost as slaves. The first man with a soul, the first Adam, I mean, that's what Adam means is, in the original Hebrew, I believe, is soul. The first man created with a soul was created probably, in all honesty, so that God would not be alone. If you think about it, you know, one of my readers told me this because one of his friends told him. And this guy, I mean, this reader that I've been talking to, he and I have been talking on and off for a long time, for about 2 years now. We know each other pretty well. An exceptionally brilliant man. I mean, he's got an IQ of like 150 plus, and has accomplished some really amazing things in his life. He was telling me about how he was at university with a friend with an IQ of like 170, something like that. Just insanely brilliant mathematician. I mean, Theodore Kaczynski level brilliant. And his friend told him, a devout Christian, unlike Ted Kaczynski, a devout Christian, his friend was sitting there one night doodling on and chatting. And out of the blue, he basically said, you know, we know that Eve was created from Adam's rib so that Adam would not be alone, so woman was created for man so that man would not be alone. Well, what if man was created for God so that God would not be alone? And all of a sudden, you know, you think about it that way, it's like, whoa, that has profound spiritual implications. I mean, really profound. Because it means that God is capable of feeling loneliness, despair, pain. And it means that our fall from grace as a species scarred him permanently. That God never recovered from what we did to him of our own free will. And yet, God has such respect for the entire concept of free will, such love for us as his children, that he won't violate our sacred right to live as we choose. That is astonishing, if you think about it. How many of us would have the same patience with our children if they kept constantly refusing to listen to us, constantly went against our will, constantly did the wrong thing? How many of us would be patient enough to let them get away with that without belting them, you know, without decking them, without cutting them off from us, without just expelling them from our presence, without saying, get out of here, go forth, live your life as you please, don't ever bother me again? How many of us would have that level of patience? Not many. I don't think many of us would be able to tolerate such a relationship with our kids. God tolerates it. God embraces it. God deals with it somehow. And if you're in tune enough and you have enough spiritual understanding, I don't claim to have it, by the way. And let me, at this point, issue my standard disclaimer about anything related to spirituality, faith, religion, whatever. I may be a Christian, but I'm an exceptionally bad one. So anyone who listens to one single word that I have to say about anything related to Christianity is well advised to be deeply skeptical. Don't take my word for granted. Don't listen to me without skepticism. Be assured that my knowledge and understanding of these things is pretty poor, and my ability to live in harmony with the word of Christ is low. I am a sinner, and I regret that deeply, but I am what I am. I try to be better. I try not to do bad things, and I usually fail, unfortunately. So, don't take what I have to say on these things without a big grain of salt. That being said, returning to the topic, the problem, the issue that God has with us as sinners is not so much that we do bad things, because what is the arbiter of what is bad? Well, that is God. That is who determines what is good and what is bad. It is that we do bad things and then don't repent them. We don't regret it, that we've done terrible things. Ultimately, sin comes down to a very simple concept. Sin is not simply doing something bad. You can do many bad things by human understanding, but that doesn't necessarily make them bad by God's understanding. I mean, it's not good, but it's not horrible either. The worst thing that you can do is to defy the will of God. Sin comes from breaking with what God wants for you. That is the true nature of sin, and it is very dangerous, indeed deadly, to a man's soul to do it. Lying is essentially a betrayal of God's trust. Lying essentially means that you deceive yourself and others away from what the Lord wants for you. And the moment you do this, you expose yourself to a number of very terrible outcomes. Which is why the greatest lies ever told are so dangerous. The first of these great lies, the greatest of them, is, of course, as I've said before, the idea that you shall be as gods. You can't be as your own God. You can't. People have tried throughout history to remake the world in their own image, and they've always failed, and the consequences have always been absolutely horrifying. You cannot become a god. You are merely a man. Without that ability to be immortal and see into the future, far into the future, all of the potential consequences of your actions, all of the outcomes, all of the effects, you cannot possibly understand what it means to be a god. The reason, one very good example of someone who tried to play God in some ways and suffered terribly for it is, in fact, the guy I just mentioned earlier, Theodore Kaczynski. Now, the reason I bring this up is because I just finished watching the series Manhunt Unabomber on Netflix. A really good series. I mean, Ted Kaczynski comes across as a very deeply tragic and, you know, flawed human being. I mean, there's no question he was a psychopath and a killer. I mean, he was just a horrible, horrible person. But there's also no question that he is an omega male, twisted and broken by a society that is deeply damaged, that is seriously problematic. Ted Kaczynski tried to play God. He tried to target people that he thought were behind the failures of current industrial society. He even wrote a manifesto. I mean, his manifesto was in Industrial Society and Its Future. And he essentially tried to play God in some ways. He tried to determine who would live and who would die in order to shock society into accepting that industrial revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. I'm quoting, paraphrasing directly from his manifesto now. Now, I haven't read it. I'm just saying that that's... I'm quoting from the film or the series where his manifesto is explored a little bit. Now, Ted Kaczynski tried very hard to determine who should be lucky enough to live, and who should be blasted, blown to smithereens, killed in horrible ways. Well, he failed, and he is now living in solitary confinement, serving 8 consecutive life sentences, unable to see the sky, the sun, the stars, the beauty of nature, surrounded on every side by concrete walls. Can you imagine an intellect like that, a man with 167 IQ, capable of understanding the most advanced esoteric mathematics possible, trapped behind 4 walls, completely isolated from the rest of humanity? I mean, that is a horrifying fate, but that's what happens when you fall for the idea that you can be a god. You can't. You can't subject yourself to these lies. Another great example of the consequence of accepting this lie is all around us. I mean, we're seeing the backlash against it around the world. This horrendous globalist ideology that says that you know, it's no problem for us to maintain open borders, for us to build a technologically driven economy with a managerial class, an elite class, and a vast underclass of peasants and serfs, that social democracy works, that basically third way politics works, that a managed economy with a specially chosen elite running everything works. It doesn't work. The entire philosophy is based on the great lie. It's based on the idea that these people know better than the rest of us. They don't. They don't know better than the rest of us. Perfect example of that can be found in India in 2016. There was a mass demonetization drive wherein the Indian Central Bank basically created a demonetization scheme in which the 2 most valuable notes in circulation at the time were removed from circulation. They removed the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes. And that was a colossal mistake. That was a truly, I mean, gigantic mistake. The reason they did it was supposedly to mop up pools of black money, quote-unquote, and to reduce to increase the transparency of the Indian financial system. Now, you would think that given the fact that the people at the head of the Central Bank of India, or the Reserve Bank of India, as it's called, all have advanced degrees in economics, they would understand that by reducing the amount of notes in circulation, you thereby reduce the money supply, which in turn creates a massive deflationary shock, which causes the economy to contract. You would think they'd understand this, because this is what I learned in Economics 100, seriously, in the London School of Economics. That was, I don't know, when was that? that was macroeconomics, so that was second term, Lent term. And I learned that within 8 weeks of that term starting. And it wasn't news to me then either, because I'd studied economics in high school. So, I'd read through Paul Samuelson's textbook on economics. This is a very, very famous textbook by former, well, he's deceased now, he's dead, MIT and Yale professor Paul Samuelson. Paul Samuelson is a legendary figure in the field of economics, and he wrote pretty much the standard, bog standard textbook on the subject. And I read through it when I was in high school because I really found the subject of economics quite fascinating. So I knew from the age of about 17 that this was a terrible idea. 17 odd years later, guess what happened? The Indian chief economists all decided that it was a good idea to introduce a huge deflationary shock. Why? Because of the hubris, the pride that comes from pretending that you're a god. You're not a god. You're not a god. All you are is a human being with delusions of grandeur at that point. You see this a lot in communist and socialist societies as well. They think that they are, that the ruling elites always think that they are better than everyone else. And that gives them the right to lord over everyone and everything else. Well, it doesn't. These people are simply stupid and delusional. And they enforce their rule, they enforce their practices through fear, intimidation, and terror. And that brings us to the second great lie. The idea that you have to face these things alone. The idea that you are alone. Now, this one cuts pretty close to the bone for me because that's what I've been dealing with for a long time. I've had a lot of bad stuff happen to me over the last 2 years. I mean, my life literally fell apart 2 years ago. Almost exactly 2 years ago now. And ever since then, I've just been unable, pretty much, to get back up and refocus. For a number of reasons. Many of them are self-inflicted. I'll be very honest about that. But some of them have to do with the fact that I come from a country with a really terrible passport. Nothing much I can do about that. Beyond, very limited attempts to move beyond that crap. Now, it's a very difficult fight when every single thing you ever do simply goes away, simply fails to work. It's a very miserable experience when every single thing you do falls apart. Every single thing you touch doesn't work. Every attempt to break out of your situation goes wrong. Every time you get a little bit of hope, it gets yanked away. Now, this is very, very hard on a man's psychology. It's very hard on a man's sense of stability, emotional well-being, everything. It's extremely destructive. Nonetheless, you have to maintain hope. Because if you don't, you succumb to that great lie, the second great lie, that you are alone and that no one can help you, that you have to face everything alone. The moment you do this, the great enemy has won. The great deceiver has you right where he wants you. Because the moment you believe that you're alone and you're stuck and there's nothing you can do to change your situation, something always comes along, someone always comes along and offers you a way out. But it'll be a very scary kind of offer. It won't seem scary. I mean, it will seem wonderful, like you're in the depths of despair and somebody comes along and says, "Hey, why don't you come along and meet some of my friends? I'll introduce you. I'll show you around." And you walk into a bar or a club or a coffee shop even, And you'll get kind of this weird vibe that, I mean, if you're, again, if you're spiritually in tune, and even if you're not, you'll still have enough good sense to figure out that something's not quite right. You'll shake hands with a few people, you'll meet a few guys and girls, and then they'll be like, okay, I mean, this isn't a bad crowd, maybe they're not so terrible. But there's something a little off about them, you know, there's something that just doesn't quite make sense. And you realize, I don't know, I'm not entirely comfortable. But you'll get your first opportunity in a very, very long time, and you'll be like, wow, fantastic. I finally caught a lucky break. And you'll jump headlong into whatever it is your new friend has planned for you. And little by little, you'll be asked to do things and see things and experience things that don't sit well with you, don't feel right, but you'll go along with them anyway, because you're beholden now to this person who's done these things for you. And slowly, 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 your sense of what is right and what is wrong will get chipped away until one day you're going to be asked to take the ticket. You're going to be asked, okay, I'm going to give you everything you could possibly want. Fame, riches, you know, wealth, women, money, houses, everything you could possibly want. Every one of your heart's desires will be fulfilled. All you have to do is take the ticket. All you have to do is sign on the dotted line, sign this contract, and you will have every material blessing you could possibly ask for. Well, here's the thing. Once you sign on that line, you're done. There's no way back for you, except through the Lord. You're not going to be able to get back out from under that thumb until you renounce all of those things and walk away from it completely. Our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, peace be unto him, Vox Dei, has addressed this exact topic repeatedly in his dark streams. Vox Dei himself was an avowed hedonist. I mean, he was an agnostic and very much a happy hedonist. He enjoyed the pleasures in life. He came from a very wealthy family. He himself became independently wealthy fairly quickly because he has a tremendous entrepreneurial spirit and really a drive to get things done. He was able to create an organization that created a really powerful video card long before the people at Nvidia were anywhere close to coming up with an equivalent. I mean, he had a video card and I think he had a sound card for 3D accelerated graphics and sound long before the people at Nvidia and Turtle Beach or Sound Blaster had anything even close, Creative Labs, whatever. Now, those ventures failed, I mean, pretty spectacularly. You know, he could have been a billionaire at a young age if they had succeeded, but they failed. Blew up in his face. I mean, he's lost more than any of us could ever dream of having. But he learned a lot from those lessons, from those situations. And in his 20s, he was, by his own admission, very much a hedonist. He was part of a multi-platinum, record-selling, Grammy-nominated, I think, band called Psychosonic. I'd never even heard of them until he mentioned them, and then I went and looked them up, and apparently they were a big deal, on the club scene back in the day. But he had, you know, a number of Billboard, chart-topping hits. There were a techno music group, you know, from 1992 to 97, for instance, with some, you know, fairly esoteric themes in their lyrics. They had like four Billboard Top 40 club chart hit singles, whatever. And they went on to do some really good stuff. You know, all of the band members went on to do some seriously crazy cool stuff. You know, they've been doing some like the band members from Psychosonic have been doing some really cool stuff ever since then. Michael Larson, for instance, was the audio director for Fenris Wolf and for Epic Games, and he was involved in the Gears of War series. So when Vox Day talks about his links in the video game industry, he's not lying. The guy has some deep, deep links with some very high-ranking people in that industry. But Vox, back in the day, had a Porsche, which he loved. He would wear designer Armani jeans. He would walk around in Ray-Ban sunglasses. He would think nothing of spending huge amounts of money on wardrobes and cars and going to the fanciest nightclubs and restaurants in Minneapolis. He dated a lot of beautiful women, but it was all hedonism. It was all just partying. He himself will tell you that his greatest joy and pleasure comes not from his professional or material accomplishments. It comes from his wife and his children. Well, yeah. I mean, in the end, the material world doesn't matter. In the end, what really matters is human connection, is forming a bond, a deep, loving bond with someone else, and using that bond to create new life. That's the only thing that really matters in the end. This great lie that you're going to end up alone drives so many of us to do things which, superficially at least, make us feel good, but in the end are really horrible for us. Game is one of those things. Now, I'm not knocking game per se. I do believe that some element of game is absolutely necessary for every young man. Every man needs to understand female psychology, needs to understand why women think and act the way they do, and needs to understand how to develop a set of responses and tools that will help them decipher it and deal with it. But here's the thing. Game, as a number of Christian men in the manosphere have been saying for years now, is fundamentally a broken tool for broken people. Game is for broken women. Rush, you know, who renounced all of his game-related writing and has basically become a devout Christian, good for him, I mean, I'm very happy for him, has said repeatedly that, of late, that the materials that he learned and the stuff that he taught is actually quite dangerous for young men these days, because it teaches them to become a performing monkey, a clown, a puppet on a string dancing to the tune of a woman. And that's a horrible place for a man to be. It gets him, doing that routine gets him sex, gets him physical pleasure. And that's great. You know, that's, sex is wonderful. Sex is a truly amazing thing. It feels terrific. It feels very enjoyable. At some level, men need it. I mean, Christians can talk all we want about how, yeah, you can go without sex. Well, that's true, you can. In the same way that you can go without your favorite foods. That's true. You can do it. It's just a very miserable existence. Let's be clear about that. There's nothing fun about going without sex. All right. You can go without it, and there's nothing wrong with going without it, except for the effect that it has on a man's biology, self-esteem, testosterone levels, and many, many other things. Psychology, of course. I mean, going without sex ruins men. It breaks them. It destroys them mentally and emotionally. And it is not a good thing for them to be without it, which is why the institution of marriage was created, so that men would not be alone. Men would be able to secure the rights to sex in perpetuity, you know, with one woman, which is the way it was meant to be. It is not a good idea for a man to spread his seed as far and as wide as he wants to. Unfortunately, too many men are driven to do precisely that by the fear of being alone, because that is the great lie, that you will be alone. And it is something terrifying to all of us. The truth is, you're never alone. You're never really alone. if you just open up your heart and your mind to one source, God, the Father of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and you pray to him and you ask him for help and guidance, he's going to be there for you. He's not going to answer you directly because that's not how it works. God is not capable of standing next to us because we are sinful and broken, and he cannot stand to be around sin. Sin scarred the Lord, scarred him so badly that he cannot tolerate its presence. He cannot be around it. All he can do is provide guidance and spiritual relief from a distance. All he can do is send his only son to die for us, to intercede on our behalf, to become man, for a part of himself to become flesh, to understand what it is that men go through, and to experience many of the same temptations as men, but to reject them and ignore them entirely, to transcend them. And through that process, show us, the rest of us, the rest of mankind, what it takes to be pure and holy, and what it takes to commune with the Lord. That's the best that he can do for us, given our sinful nature. And if you think about it, that's pretty astonishing, that he can do that much for us, that he would do that much for us. But we have to accept it. We have to be willing to reach out and take his hand. And if we don't do it, then yeah, we're alone. If we do it, all of the power that the devil has comes to nothing. He can't force us to do anything the moment we are shielded and protected by that bond with the Lord. The moment that happens, the devil loses all power. He has no capacity for changing or affecting us beyond sending really difficult, painful tests our way. Beyond that, he can't do anything. So don't fall prey to this great lie that you're going to be alone. You're not. The moment you reject the idea that you're going to be alone for the rest of your life, the moment you refuse even to countenance it because you're not alone, that's the moment when you realize that despair really doesn't have very much hold on you. You can get on with doing other things. You can create things. You can go places. You can do things which you wouldn't have been able to do or see or go experience before. You can get yourself out of whatever rut it is you're in. It's just going to take time and effort. But the moment you accept that you're not alone and that you have help, whether it's human help or spiritual help, the power of this lie is greatly weakened. And that's a very important thing. You need to weaken the hold that it has, because if you don't, you're going to be led down some very, very dark roads and into some very dangerous places. If you look at, again, going back to guys who sleep with a lot of girls, they themselves will admit that any man who sleeps with over about 100 women is broken. He's not going to be able to form a long-lasting bond with a woman, at least not, you know, in a secular sense. He's not going to be able to do it until and unless he accepts Jesus, until and unless he accepts God. He's not going to be able to settle for any one woman, because the ability to form an emotional bond with that woman is going to be beyond him. It's, you know, he's going to have such a mentality of abundance that he's going to say, well, if things don't work out here, I can always jump ship and go to the next one. That's a really dreadful, stupid thing to do. It's a very terrible place to be. If you find yourself in that situation, I mean, you're in a world of trouble, because you're going to find yourself unable to pair bond with any one woman for pretty much the rest of your life. And the track record of pickup artists in this regard is truly awful. Neil Strauss, the father of modern game, pretty much, has tried repeatedly to kind of break out of the pickup artist shell and settle down. I mean, he got married to a really just gorgeous model of German and Mexican descent. I mean, her name is Ingrid de la O, and she's just stunning. They were married for like 5 years. They have a child together, and now they're divorced. Why? Well, we don't know why, but my guess is that the habits and patterns created by the pickup artist life had something to do with it. It cannot have been a particularly good thing for him to go through all of those women as he did, and he just ultimately broke. His relationship broke. It was really sad. You know, it is sad to see a pickup artist like that, you know, one of the true legends of the field, going down in flames. But that's what happened. So, what else is it about these lies that makes them so dangerous? Well, it's just the very act of lying to yourself and to others requires you to stack lie upon lie upon lie until you can't keep track of them anymore, until you can't figure out where the lies stop and the truth starts. The moment you're in that position, it's very easy to just take a wrecking ball to your sense of self-esteem. All anybody has to do is find one truth about your life and show it to you, and your entire life falls apart. And you're stuck scrambling, trying to recover. And you won't. At least not easily. Not without great and terrible pain. Because the more you lie to yourself, the more you lie to others, the more you lie to God, the more painful the reckoning is going to be when it comes. And it will come. You're going to find yourself without friends, without family, because you've alienated so many people from all the lies that you've told. And you're going to find yourself in completely isolated and cut off. And you're going to be susceptible to the lie that you're always going to be alone. The moment you simply refuse to lie anymore, the moment you simply start to tell the truth, as best as you see it, in kindness whenever you can, that's the moment that your life is going to start to turn around. Because you're going to be like, I don't want to live with lies anymore. I want to live by the truth. I want to live based on what is good, what is beautiful, and what is true. The moment you commit yourself to that, you're going to experience some very painful dislocations, because the things that you thought were true are no longer true. You'll see the lies for what they are. They will be shattered. They will be destroyed. And you will begin to understand the world as it is, not as you want it to be, but as it actually is. You're going to see it in its squalor, its corruption, greed, misery, pain, sorrow, sadness. Just, you're going to see the awful realities of human existence. It's a heartbreaking thing to go through, but the moment you do it, you're also going to see great beauty. You're going to see people as they really are. You're going to realize that people aren't all bad, and they aren't all good either. You're going to see people as broken and flawed instruments of a greater purpose. What that greater purpose is, you won't really know. It's hard to figure it out. But it's there. And you're going to realize that there is a lot out there which is open to you, which you're going to be able to enjoy much more than you ever did before. There are things out there which you can see and experience, not hedonistic pleasures, but spiritual pleasures, joys of a kind that you're going to experience on a level that you really didn't realize existed before, and which will make all of the previous secular pleasures, hedonistic pleasures that you experienced, pale by comparison. And one of those pleasures is probably going to be a wife and children. And the moment you embrace that possibility, very good things start happening to you, because you're going to really look forward to just being with one person. You're going to look forward to not being alone. You're going to cherish the moments that you spend with this one special woman who, you know, she may not be the most beautiful woman, she may not be the youngest, she may not be rich, she may not be sexy, she may not be, she may not be a number of things. Well, okay, fine, so what? She's yours. She's the woman you've committed to. She's the one that you want to be with. You're going to find it when you look into the eyes of your children and you experience the joy of seeing yourself through your child's eyes. You're going to experience it as a parent. You're going to, God willing, someday experience it as a grandparent, because you'll finally get an opportunity to spoil children rotten rather than just have to raise them. Raising children and spoiling children are two very different things. And being a grandparent is certainly a wonderful thing. I mean, I remember what it was like for my grandparents. You know, I have very fond memories of my father's parents when I was growing up, and they certainly derived immense pleasure and satisfaction from their grandkids. And I love them with all my heart. I mean, I miss them to this day, but they're gone. So the best you can do is take the values that they pass on to you and go with them, pass them on to the next generation and the generation after that. Because that's really the only way you can achieve any kind of immortality, is through your descendants, or through your works on this earth, or through taking the knee, bending before God, and accepting His offer of redemption. Because when you do that, your soul is protected. And while your physical body may be destroyed, your soul will not be. So don't fall for the lies. Don't fall for the lie that you can be as a god, because you can't. Don't fall for the lie that you're going to be alone, because you won't be. Don't fall for the lie that you can have whatever you want, because you can't. Don't fall for the lie that life is all pain and misery without any joy or happiness or love, because it's not. Don't fall for the lie that God doesn't exist, because He very plainly does. And He's going to surprise you and shock you with the ways that He's going to prove His existence. You're not going to like it when He comes knocking. It's not going to be pleasant. It's not going to be fun. It's not going to be easy. But when He comes knocking, you'll know. You will know. Well, that's about all I have to add on this subject. It's coming up on the 1 hour mark, so I think I shall wrap up here. Once again, many thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this this podcast, please leave a like. If you are not subscribed, please subscribe. And make sure you stop by the blog. Make sure you leave a comment if you are happy with what you heard. If you are not, I thank you for your patience in listening nonetheless. This has been the Didactic Mind Podcast, episode 18, The Greatest Lies. And I am the Didact. I will see you on the next one.